Talk given Friday, 8th March 1974. It is most worthwhile, particularly when we are by ourselves, to consider very deeply and very quietly the difference between pleasure and happiness. Happiness in the true sense belongs to the state of ease. It is calm. It is a rejuvenator of the living being. Pleasure, on the other hand, is not calm. It is a sensational excitement, a disturbance. It eats away our life. Those of us who are truly concerned with the religious life must be able to understand very clearly and fully this great difference between pleasure and happiness. Because the fulfillment of the living individual means the flowering of the religiousness that lies within him. And that flowering of religiousness is manifested in one's life in terms of perfect ease, poise, and this deep, imperturbable happiness. Consider this very deeply, because such consideration in itself is a power, a great power, to release us from the pressure of life outside us, from the depressing, anxiety-producing effect of difficulties, circumstantial difficulties, which we may have to face or are facing. This is something which the world at large knows nothing about. Ignorantly, people say, "Ah, now, if only I could arrange this or get that, or if this, that, or the other were to happen," and so on, "I will be happy." The person makes a picture in his mind of what happiness is, what it ought to be rather, and he wishes the circumstance to be otherwise in order that he may enjoy, as he calls it, that happiness. But you see, this is standing on one's head and not on one's feet. One is seeing the world upside down this way. It is because I am happy in the state of ease, strong, calm poise in myself, that my circumstance alters, if it is difficult or unpleasant. I use the word unpleasant, but I don't mean it will become pleasant in the purely sensational sense. This is one of the very difficult and curious things in life. Happiness is not the end of the story. It is right at the beginning. The living person who is healthy, really healthy, is happy. His body is a happy body, and it functions perfectly, doesn't it? If he's really happy, healthy and skillful, he functions perfectly. Now, the external situation, the state, for the state of which he is partly responsible and others around him are also responsible, the external situation may present problems, difficulties. But if he maintains his poise, his happiness, then he will be a powerful influence for changing that circumstance. Now, if we have real intelligence and perception, we must beware of one thing above all: not to wish the present circumstance to be otherwise, and particularly, very particularly, not to try to predetermine or make a picture of what the right circumstance is or should be. This is our very, very great difficulty, simply because all our conditioning has made us what we are. That is why we do the wrong thing in all these situations of difficulty. I know about this. I've lived long enough in the world to have been through all this kind of thing. And I've also lived long enough, and shall I put it this way, fortunately enough, to see the fact, actually to experience the fact, that when one lets go wishing the thing otherwise and prefiguring the ought-to-be situation, just being quiet, doing nothing about it, as the world would say, the thing rights itself. It's like one of those little toy men, you know, which children play with. Whichever position you put the man, he comes right. Well, that little toy doesn't predetermine anything. Gravity does everything for it. It's constituted so that it comes right. Now, in actual fact, we also are inwardly constituted so that we would come right. If we only let the thing come right, it is we who are opposing the rightness all the time due to our conditioning. due also therefore to the fact that we just cannot differentiate between pleasure and happiness, between true fulfillment or flowering and achievement or attainment, which is the end point of our particular desire. We must let all this go. It will rise up, desires will rise, plans will arise, but be mindful, watch them. It's so easy to feel resentful against life, particularly in recent times and in our own day and age. Things are obviously difficult, obviously getting more chaotic and so forth. And we feel resentment against it because it entails difficulty for us. Of course it does. But this is the test, isn't it? Tribulation is the test. Are we truly religious? Are we truly concerned with the holy life? With the life which is whole and healthy, which is pure, simple? Are we truly concerned with that? Or are we self-deluded? It really is extremely difficult to penetrate into this. But look out for some of the signs. If one is more or less, to use the common phrase, on the right lines, living in rhythm with the trend of the great river of life itself, then one notices that one becomes free of reactions of greed, of anger, of resentment, the endless criticism and so forth. The criticism which is merely a reaction of anger and not a calm, balanced judgment. Calm, balanced judgment is a very different thing. There, of course, you see the evil as the evil and the good as the good, unquestionably, you do. But the reaction which attends it. Now watch those reactions. And whenever ideas come up about, oh, it ought to be like this or it ought to be like that, very calmly watch. Is this delusion? Is this the immature mind at work, producing illusory pictures, utopias, nirvanas, and whatnot, which just don't exist? You might wonder, what? He says Nirvana doesn't exist, but the Buddha most positively affirmed Nirvana does exist. Nirvana is. But you read your Prajnaparamita and see the refutation of all these statements. The reality which is Nirvana is unknown to me, to my mind, to the brain. It's unknown. This is the great mysterious unknown. It is in its absoluteness. But when I use the words Nirvana is, if I can keep my eyes open and there is no dust in my eyes, I will see that I have projected a picture in my mind of that Nirvana. And that picture is everlastingly false. Neither you nor I, nor a Siddhartha Gautama, if I said Siddhartha Gautama, could project a mind picture, could produce a mental construct, which is Nirvana. It's totally impossible. Because this reality is related to a dimension, a profundity of awareness which none of us know anything about or are capable of producing. We sometimes, because of our happy, sublime moments when we experience something quite wonderful, say, not quite unjustifiably, had a glimpse of Nirvana. All right, we did. But the moment we try to say it was like this and like that and so forth, then we are caught in our trap. We are telling lies, to put it harshly. We are spinning intellectual cobwebs. Then, instead of being the spider comfortably seated in the center of a cobweb, I am the fly caught in my own cobweb. So now, this implies that we have to remain in a state of search and not to seek. The two are quite different from each other. The state of search is the state of totally open-minded and fully open-hearted alertness. The mind is alert, awake, it's not sleeping. That is the state of search. Reality, truth, will pour its influence, will influence that open mind and that open heart, and produce external results in terms of the mental states and the physical actions which we perform. But description, never. This is the point. Reality, truth, happiness, they are all nondescript. Whatsoever is the descript is the mortal. It's a little something which appears on the scene, proceeds and vanishes, dies. But the nondescript is that which does not begin. It is, but it never begins. Therefore it can never end. And you see, this, to be able to really to penetrate into this, meaning to be able to live it with one's whole being, involves a discipline in which we must learn to let go of all concepts ideas, beliefs, and so forth. They are working tools for the immediate moment. But what we do is, we hold on to the tool instead of the finished product for which that tool was used for manufacturing. If I use tools to make a really good vehicle, the tools won't take me anywhere. It's that vehicle which will. But we cling to the tools. We don't let them go. So we must learn to let go, not to cling to anything at all. Cling to nothing at all. And this is extremely difficult, isn't it? Look at us from infancy onwards. Look at our involuntary movements. Look at the babe grasping with its hands and fingers. Whatever you give it, it puts into its mouth straight away to gobble it up. That's exactly what we do right through our lives. Whatsoever we can lay our hands on, we want to gobble it up. So, what happens? We are ill at ease afterwards. Just like the baby will cry lustily if it swallows the wrong things, don't we complain against life lustily for having swallowed all the wrong things? But who asked us to swallow those things? We did it ourselves. Now, this business of pleasure, contrasted with the reality of happiness. Pleasure originates in the unintelligent use of the senses. If we didn't have any senses functioning, there'd be no such thing as going after pleasure, a formal pleasure. When I'm asleep, for instance, rarely asleep, all my senses also have gone to sleep. Then there is no activity, no planning, no grasping after particular forms of pleasure. I'm asleep. I'm restful. But what happens in that state of deep sleep? I'm really recharged and really alive, aren't I? My ill condition is made well in that deep sleep. Or at least more or less made well. So I get up refreshed. Now, the senses. How do we look at things? How do we listen to anything? We are always plagued with the image. And what I'll let us consider together again this business of what is meant by being plagued by the image. You meet a person whom you have known for a long time, as we say, oh, I've known him for 50 years. What precisely do I know about him? The image which is in my brain cells. Oh, that's John Smith. I know him. Yes. And that image is associated with a whole host of memories about him. Oh, yes. We lunched together at such and such a pub or whatever it was and all the rest of it. A whole host of memories. So when I see John Smith, I immediately recognize not John Smith, but my image of him. Now, how do I form this image? Not merely through the accumulation of my experiences of him. That is, of course, one of the main factors. But with every contact with him, with every experience which I've had in relation to him, all my conditioning has pronounced judgment, has come to play. All my ignorance, all my flaws, all my canniness has been at it. And I've got an image of John Smith. And I flatter myself, oh, I'm a cute and penetrating one. John Smith's a jolly good fellow. Of course he has such and such little peccadillos and this, that and the other. But that's all right. Or that's not all right. And my all right or not all right is the result of my petty little ambivalent moral standard. Not the true morality, which is the real sealers. Switch it off. So you see, that image which I have in my mind is a marvelous conglomerate of all that is untrue to John Smith. And that is how, it's now 50 years since I've known John Smith, and I meet him today, and that's how I look at him now, the living John Smith. I'm looking at the image in my mind, which is being modified all the time with further experience and so forth. But the modification is affected with this conditioning of mine, my own conditioning, bedeviling the whole, the entire observation and the meeting. But you see, how impossible it is to be a true friend to John Smith under those circumstances. I am harming him, I am hurting him, the real John Smith. And I am not only harming and hurting him, but also myself. Because there is nothing whatsoever at any split second of my existence that I can think, feel, speak or do which does not immediately bring about a result in my own being. This is why karma is inescapable. Because all that is me, myself, now. And it acts upon me. Just like any two chemicals coming together will produce a reaction. Can't avoid it. It's there right away, all the time. Karma is inescapable. That is why the mills of God grind slowly, but they grind exceeding fine. Not just fine, exceeding fine, meaning to absolute perfection. They go on. Nothing can go against the law of life itself. Otherwise we wouldn't be alive. As long as we are alive, the law of life operates supremely, predominantly over us. So now, when I meet John Smith, all these things happen. Now, if I take the trouble to look at John Smith, really to look at him. What is the essential prerequisite for me to be able to look, truly look, in the pure way, the clean way, the whole way? The prerequisite is that I must be free of this devil, the image in my mind. Mustn't I? Now I can't catch hold of that image and throw him out of the window. That image is part and parcel of me myself. But if I am aware, really aware of the fact, I am looking at him, I am looking at that, my image of him. Now, if I am intensely aware of the fact, it's one of the mysteries of the psyche, that the psyche relaxes its grip. It is as if the psyche, like a terrible eagle's, got its talons into that image, and the eagle retracts his talons, lets go. This is how it does happen if one practices mindfulness, observation. If one practices being really aware, awake, then one finds that this is what does happen, or something like this does happen in the psyche. And then you are able to pay attention in the true sense to John Smith. You see, this is the fundamental secret of observation, which is becoming true mindfulness. Otherwise, all our mindfulness is just one vast illusory process. We are fooling ourselves all the time that we are getting self-aware or aware or awake or this, that, or the other, progressing on the path. All that is self-oriented. Now when I'm able to pay attention in this very intense way, this open-minded, open-hearted way to John Smith, the real John Smith completely fills my attention. Which means that there is no room for me in that attentiveness. There is no separate me. There is only pure attentiveness. Now look, there is an outstanding difference, an unbridgeable gulf between the two, in fact. Between merely being conscious of John Smith and being fully aware of him. In consciousness, there is always the self, the separate subject, who is conscious of the other self, the other thing, the object, the observed object, the object of consciousness. That means that there is a division between him or the thing and me. And as long as that division is there, there is never true communication. You see? And there is never that observation which transcends all limiting and limited criteria and standards and all the rest of it. So when open-mindedly, open-heartedly, my attentiveness glows and glows, becomes white hot, so that there is no me anymore, but only that attentiveness, and John Smith fills that attentiveness, then I am truly looking at him. Until then, whenever I see anything, I am seeing with an eye that is tainted. My eyes are covered with dust. My eyes are tainted with greed, with hate. Hate because there is always an antagonism between anything which is other to me and myself. There is this ambivalent mystery, the love-hate play. Look, have you watched a child, or recall your own childhood? A beautiful flower, you liked it, and so forth. And then something comes up, and you tear it aside with violence, with your teeth clenched, maybe. Watch children do that. All of us do it. We never grow out of our childhood. See, what is the significance of that? It is the other thing, the flower. The flower doesn't completely fill the child's attention. Of course, it's a child. It can't do any different. Now, you and I have to grow out of that. The body has grown to 20, 30, 40, 70, 150. But the mind is as immature as it can possibly be. Is it surprising that in some degree or other, in some form or other, we are all schizophrenics and so forth? We are not whole beings, we are split beings. Therefore, I cannot look, really look, at John Smith. Now, when the consciousness, the ordinary consciousness, has been transcended, this thing which, for which we use the word awareness is present, that awareness is not my awareness. My consciousness, yes. As long as there is anything functioning in me, which is the producer, the maintainer of separateness, of otherness with respect to existence, the totality of existence, I can say that that is my consciousness. It is the divider. Anything which is of the limited I, or my, or mine, is the divider, the sinner. See, the meaning, we can never repeat this too often. The fundamental meaning of the word sin, anything which sunders or attempts to sunder the fundamental unity of the universe, that is sin. Blessed are the peacemakers. Finish it. For they shall be called the children of God. The children of God. The absolute good. The all. The totality. So now, when consciousness of John Smith, as I look at him, is transformed into this, through this complete and total attention into pure awareness, transcendence itself has absolutely taken over. Now, when I look at John Smith, when I see John Smith, it's no longer being conscious of him in terms of greed or hate, however subtly they may be hidden. But when I really look at him, so that there is this pure awareness, the sight of him means that I am looking at him with love. Then love is present. The thing I don't know, the thing I cannot describe. But because that love is there, I am at peace with John Smith present. Because that love is there, and I am really looking at him and in communion with him, there is only him. There is only the one reality, so to say, you see. Therefore, if there is anything ill or difficult or hurtful in John Smith, it is John Smith also experiences the healing effect. Surely you have all experienced, we have all experienced in our own little way, sometime or other in our life, somebody comes to us in difficulty or trouble. And somehow, even to just the ghost of the reality has taken place. And the person says, "Oh, I'm so glad I came and saw you. I do feel so much better." And really, I mean, the problem is not at all particularly important. And he's so happy and he goes happy. He goes happy. He hasn't had a gay time eating, drinking, shouting, the usual subhuman manifestations. Now you see, the senses then. The sense of sight. We have considered the sense of sight. It's the same with whatsoever one hears. If I am truly listening, in the true listening, there is perfect communion. There is this awareness which takes over. And through the phenomenon of hearing, because I am truly listening, I listen with love. And this love is associated with wisdom. That is a way of talking. They are an identity, in fact. All these words are just words. Call it whatever you like. And it is in this state that one truly understands. Otherwise there is no understanding. Understanding ordinarily means, according to the dictionary and according to the world's common usage, intellectual comprehension. That is understanding. Oh, I've understood the theorem or the difficulty or the machine or how it works or etc., etc. That is intellectual comprehension. That is analytical. You've taken the bits apart. But when you take the bits apart, let us remember the flower, the petals apart. Now, produce the flower again. You and I can't. So you see, understanding is something which totally transcends mere intellectual comprehension. I must admit that this I must take responsibility for this particular meaning I give to the word understanding. But if you like to invent another word in the language, we might use that just as well, a new word in the language. But understanding is a word which people in the past have used in a sense somewhat similar to this, at least, if not quite like this. Was it not Solomon, "Give me understanding, O Lord, and I will fulfill thy statutes unto the end." That means in fullness. Give me understanding. And it is this thing. Understanding is compassionate wisdom. It is wise compassion. So, when I listen in that way, understanding is there, communion is there. But don't forget the fundamentally important thing. The utter freedom of the mind from everything that clutters it. All beliefs, ideas, concepts, conditioning, standards, criteria, judgments, everything, out they go. When they are out, the mind is still and silent. It is in the state of ease. You are happy. And in that state of happiness, this marvelous thing can happen. Now this is the reality of nirvana here now in terms of the forms of our day-to-day experience. Now be very careful. Be very careful, penetrate right deeply into it. Don't muddle up the reality of nirvana and the word happy with that which is pleasant. My friend has done some terrible criminal act and he is now being executed. My friend, my brother, my son, my father, he is now being executed. Watch. If I can see with the totally empty mind, the stillness and the silence, the truth of things is a happy state. That is happiness. Quite different from our conceptions of happiness, which are always misconceptions. Our conception of pleasure is right. What we know here and now, we know very well because we know the wrong. Because we are in the wrong state. Therefore we really know it. What you really know, you are. You are that which you know. Plato said that too. So now, when nirvana is yourself, then the transcendence of all this has taken place. And the senses, which are the root sources of our trouble, pleasure and all the rest of it, greed, resentment, frustration, bondage, difficulties, and all the rest of it, these very senses become the cords of communion. They are indispensable. Let us just turn our attention to one other thing. You know the story of how the Buddha is walking along and entering a woodland where that terrible robber, Angulimala, lived. The whole country was terrified of Angulimala, from the king downwards. Angulimala was such a robber, so strong and so fierce and terrible, that nobody ever dared to go through that woodland, excepting unless he was accompanied by at least 30 or 40 people. And even then, sometimes, the whole lot of them suffered a terrible fate, because he would slay all of them, and he would take the bones of their, a bone out of their, out of one of their fingers, and put it on his enormously long necklace, which reached down nearly to the ground. That was Angulimala. And he, of course, he robbed them of whatever they had. And friends warned in the village warned the Buddha, don't go any further. Angulimala lives here. Three times they gave him the warning. He listened silently, went on. Angulimala saw him coming, and he said, there's that recluse, the son of the Sakyans. Now what? How would it be if I took my weapons and slew him and robbed him of what? His begging bowl and the rags which were his robes. And the Buddha just walked on quite quietly. And Angulimala, who was probably somewhere lurking, then followed him, behind him. And then he thought, oh, I'll now run along and slay him. And he couldn't, although he was running with all his, with might and main, as it is put in the texts, couldn't catch up with the Buddha. So he shouted to him, hey, recluse, stand still, stand still. And the Buddha said very quietly, you stand still. And then he said, the robber said, no, I am running along trying to get at you, and you are not standing still. And the Buddha said, it is I who am standing still, but you are unable to catch up with me. Something like that. The conversation goes on. And Angulimala says, explain, how can this happen? And the Buddha says, I am one who has given up the stick. The first rule of the holy life, to be harmless. Therefore, his mind is filled completely with loving kindness and compassion. And that influence was so powerful that the robber couldn't get near him to harm him. And Angulimala undergoes a conversion, you know, and he hurls his sword and his shield and all his weapons down a cliff. very conveniently in the story, the cliff was just near there. But these are delightful stories. They are so instructive, really. And they have a very profound truth in them. Where the mind is utterly pure and loving, truly loving, in the sort of sense in which we've tried to understand it this evening, no one else's mind can remain unloving, can remain resentful, evil. So, the senses, the right use of the senses, and let them grow into cords of communion.